Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Frank Anderson. Psychiatrist and psychotherapist, Dr. Frank Anderson specializes in the treatment of trauma and dissociation and is passionate about teaching brain-based psychotherapy and integrating current neuroscience knowledge with the internal family systems model of therapy. Dr. Anderson is a lead trainer and program consultant for the IFS Institute, is an advisor to the International Association of Trauma Professionals, and maintains a private practice. His book, Transcending Trauma, Healing Complex PTSD with Internal Family Systems, is fantastic for anybody that wants to learn about trauma, as well as anybody treating people with trauma in a therapeutic setting. Dr. Frank Anderson, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here. So I'm honored to be asked back again. So thank you.
Frank, I would love it if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and what inspired your work in trauma.
Yeah, boy, that's a interesting journey. always good to kind of reflect on. I would say, like most people, my journey started externally focused and then it shifted internally. So I had a really close family member who I grew up with, who ended up having kind of psychotic episodes when they were younger, and it had a profound impact on me. It was devastating for me. And I had this like, oh my goodness, I need to help this person. Like the ultimate in caretakers within me got activated because I always thought I would be a pediatrician. I've loved kids my whole life. And it's kind of like, oh, I want to be a doctor someday and I want to be a pediatrician. So when my family member had this mental illness kind of pop up for them, it really shifted things for me. Unbeknownst to me at the time that was the beginning of my own personal healing journey, because that event kind of moved me into psychiatry as opposed to pediatrics. And I was also, so when I was in medical school, I couldn't tolerate really, really sick kids. Like that was another kind of sign for me at the time. Like, this is too painful. I can't work with kids in the PICU. I remember the pediatric intensive care unit was too much for me. So I did moved into psychiatry for my field of specialty. And then lo and behold, when I started getting into my own therapy, I was like, wait a minute here. There's a lot about what's going on in this mental health world that has to do with me. And it's also nice and altruistic that it has to do with other people that I love and care about. So it really kind of came full circle for me when I started kind of discovering, oh, maybe I'm in this field, the wounded healer, so to speak, right? So I have to say it's been a both and. I've loved helping people throughout the course of my career. It's been really rewarding to be able to do that. And I've gone through so much healing myself. I almost feel like a totally transformed, a different person than I was when I started this journey. So it's been so personally rewarding as well as professionally rewarding. So it's a win-win, and I kind of feel like I was meant to do this.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, because I think it always resonates with people more, and myself included in that, when people have a personal connection to the work and have walked the journey, if you will, that we're telling people is hopeful and possible, right?
That's right. That is probably my biggest mission. Like, I have this purpose of trauma healing in the world. But more specifically, I want to show people that healing is possible by example. So there's one thing to sit and lecture people, a group of people about that. And there's another thing to show them through personal example that this is possible. So thank you for noticing that, because it's so important to me.
Absolutely. So I had the privilege of interviewing Dick Schwartz for the Trauma Super Conference as well, but I would love if you could give us an example of an explanation of what the internal family systems model of therapy is in your own words.
Yeah, that's great. So it's wonderful that you were able to talk to Dick, who's obviously the founder of the model, right? I feel like I've been so lucky to come across this model years ago. I think 2004, when I had done a conference at Bessel van der Kolk's trauma conference, and Dick Schwartz had done a workshop there also at the same time. So there was this kind of confluence. And I had been working with trauma at Bessel van der Kolk's trauma center for years. And then I met Dick Schwartz and I was like, oh, wow, there's something different here. There was this kind of taking traumatized parts out of the scene and bringing them somewhere safe in the present, this idea of full release, it was a whole new concept for me. And it kind of got me hooked in that moment. So for me, there is, and I know IFS has many different applications. For me, it's a beautiful model for trauma healing, and obviously it's used in a lot of different ways. But I focus on particularly the way IFS is used for treating trauma, particularly, relational trauma or complex trauma, but trauma in general. So for me, there is this way that a chasm gets created as a result of trauma. And when I talk about chasm, is I'm meaning a chasm between ourselves and our parts. An IFS view is that everybody has parts and everybody has self. It's kind of who we are, right? There's a chasm that gets created as a result of overwhelming life experience, which leads this break internally. So we have our parts that were really left behind to manage the trauma or to endure the trauma. And then there's a self that gets protected and doesn't get traumatized by the event. So we end up with all these symptoms, which end up being parts of us that have had to take on extreme roles. And they take on extreme roles to protect. So we have parts that protect by drinking, parts that protect by cutting, parts that protect by overworking, parts that protect by laughing all the time to cover up uncomfortable feelings. Any range of normal parts of us or aspects of our personality that will take on extreme roles in the service of protection. And we also have the parts that endure the pain or the wound of the overwhelming life experience. So we have those parts too that carry wounds. And the IFS model, from my perspective, is a beautiful way to repair the chasm, the internal attachment work that has been severed as a result of trauma or overwhelming life experience. And the more we do that, and I'm going to say this personally as well as professionally, the more we do that, the more our authentic self we become, and the more the parts that we're protecting no longer need to protect. So they're freed up to be their authentic self. And the parts that carry wounds no longer carry that pain or overwhelming life experience. So they're freed up. So like we become a more integrated self as a result of doing this trauma healing work. We all have parts anyways. The belief is we're born with parts, but it's the extreme nature of trauma that causes them to have difficulties and cause trouble in our lives, trouble in our work lives, with our kids, in our relationships. And so it's kind of releasing those parts from those extreme roles and extreme burdens that really allows people to be their authentic selves.
Yeah, I love the context of we all have parts, and it's the trauma that disintegrates kind of the function, the behavior of the parts, right? The self-awareness of this part is what this part is doing and why. It's that kind of that break between those behaviors. I had this vision when you were describing it, which I've been familiar with parts work for years and years, but this is the first time I've had this. So tell me, you're like, that's way off base, but it's like, I used to work in television and I used to work with a lot of celebrities, and this thing would happen, especially if they had handlers. So people that were working on their behest, right? Is that occasionally we would have a really, really big name that had a ton of different kinds of handlers, and the handlers behaved terribly. They mistreated everyone. They had huge demands. They, were late, or, all of these like misbehaviors, and that affected the reputation of the person that they were trying to protect and serve.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Right. And so that's what I see, or that's kind of like the visual that I was coming up with, is like the reputation of the self is being affected by all of these protective parts that are doing their best, but not behaving in a way that actually serves the self, because of all the kind of this break.
I love that analogy. It's not everybody has that insider view of the entertainment industry like you do, which I think is great, but it's a perfect representation. And the other thing I'll say about it is these handlers are not very well equipped. And in the trauma world, they're not very well resourced, right? So they don't really represent the self in the way that they should, because they're typically young, or they're kind of forced into those roles at the time of these traumas. So these are kind of ill-equipped handlers who don't really, shouldn't be in the role and are forced in the role against their opinion, you know, against their better advice, but they have no choice but to do it. So it's kind of a setup for the poor handlers, and it's a setup for the self, because right. It doesn't represent the authenticity, right? So, I mean,
that brings up a really good point, which is that a lot of times parts are chronologically not the age you are currently, right? They form and they take on their job at a different chronological age than you are presently. Yeah. And that's what you mean when you say, like, they aren't, they haven't been properly trained. They're not adult right. parts often. Mm-hmm. They're child parts that were doing the best with what they had at that moment.
And they still need to keep doing it, which is part of the problem, right? We do, one of the things we do in IFS when you're working with trauma healing is update the parts of the past to the self of today. Okay, because there is this chasm that I said gets created. So they're moving along, drinking or doing whatever they're doing in the way that they know how. And they don't even know that there's an evolved self in there that they can trust and rely on, because they're kind of working like hamsters on a wheel. They're very independent. So the updating is kind of the first step in repair. Like when we say, hey, drinking part, look, there's somebody in there, you know, shift your focus, take a look. There's somebody in there that can really help, that loves you. They're like, oh, I had no idea. You know, you get these really interesting responses when people are doing this internal work, because it's very internal. It's not talk therapy, right? It's a very internal kind of work. So you'll get these young parts look, say, hey, you know, see the person that's there today, that's able, you know, the wise self, the higher wisdom. You can use any kind of word, soul, you know, whatever words. And they'll look sometimes like, I didn't know we survived. Or, oh my goodness, you're so old. Like they really are stuck in the past and they're doing these things. I had one client who her drinking part was 8 years old. Right. And she was like, how could that be? 8 year olds don't drink scotch. Right. I said, I don't know. Let's explore that a little bit more. And what she found, lo and behold, which made so much sense when you start getting curious, right, is this 8 year old part of her used to see mommy and daddy go into the parlor and have a cocktail every night when daddy came home from work. And what ended up happening was the cocktail stopped all the fighting and yelling and screaming in the house. Right. So this 8 year old part of my client's like, ah, I know, drinking cocktails stops problems. So it was this 8 year old part that would reach for scotch every time there was something disruptive in her life or uncomfortable. So it was this little part who, well intended, right, who does this behavior because it's what they knew and what they saw, what they took in. And they were trying their best to kind of deal with overwhelm, deal with difficult feelings. And they didn't know that there's somebody else in there who might be more equipped, right, to be able to handle it. And once you have that, what I call internal repair, the part says, wow, I had no idea you're there now. I only knew you back then. And then the self, honestly, will apologize. The beautiful repair, the self says, I am so sorry. I'm sorry you've been alone doing this all by yourself. And I'm sorry I couldn't help you back then. I was also 8. I did the best I could. So there's a beautiful, like, relational repair that happens internally as a result of overwhelming experiences that are really externally imposed on our system. So it's an important, yeah, so it's like relational therapy turned inside.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. And so much of our audience is female. And so I'm going to share this example. As I said, I've been doing parts work as well. But, you know, when you were speaking to that, I also want to illustrate an example of, because there's lots of parts that take on behaviors that have diminishing returns, such as, like, you know, self-harm or substance use, things like that. But there's also parts that take on roles that have diminishing returns, but that are approval, that have high approval in, like, society and culture, right?
Yes.
Right. Yes. And so, like, since a large part of our audience is female, I'll disclose this, but, like, I've had a chronically ill parent since I was 8 years old. And so, and I'm an oldest daughter, and there's memes all over the internet about the oldest daughters of the world, right? But, yeah. You know, so you can write that story. It's familiar to a lot of people, but because I had a chronically ill parent, like I took on the role of overfunctioning and being overparentified and being taking on more than was my responsibility to do at 8 years old. Right. And so through parts work, I was able to really disarm and heal that rupture of like, you're doing too much. You're taking on too much. I have the self-healing to discern what is my responsibility and what is not. Right.
Yeah. And kids don't have that luxury. First, you know, adults don't take responsibility. Number one, oh, honey, I'm so sorry. I'm supposed to be doing this and I can't. It's not your responsibility. So kids automatically take responsibility for things that weren't taken responsibility for. And then that part of you that steps in, that takes on that role of caretaker, right, is doing the best it can. And oh, yes, by the way, it gets reinforced by culture and society and the family. So those are parts that are like proactive and preventative is the way I think about those parts, is that they do really important jobs to make sure everything runs smoothly. And they get reinforced by culture and society, which makes it harder for them in some ways to let go of those roles and those jobs. Oh my goodness. Speaking of a firstborn caretaker, like put me in there. Right, mentor right. Too, Megan, mentor too. Like I was like so part of that, right? Care. I think every therapist out there, honestly, has huge caretaker parts. Otherwise you wouldn't be a therapist. Like yeah, it's what exactly. We do for a living, right? It's what we do for a living. So, you know, kids love these caretaking parts. Bosses love these caretaking parts. Companies love them. So it's really hard to let go of those roles because they become this identity, right? As opposed to love me for who I am, as opposed to what I can do. So that becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy that's very hard to get out of, which is different than those extreme parts we talk about, the parts that cut and drink and binge or take heroin or are suicidal.
Those parts in the IFS model have different kind of labels. We don't have to really get into it too much, but the ones that we were just talking about being more like firefighter, right? Like, right? Or exile. Sorry. Yeah, yeah.
No. The ones we were just talking about, those caretakers, the IFS language for those are managers. They manage the situation. I'm not a big fan of that terminology. It's kind of, I like the parts to let us know their role.
Without labeling them.
Yeah, I'm not, but it is what the model is, right? Which is totally fine. And the other part, these extreme parts, the ones that caught and binge and purge and are suicidal, shame, dissociate, right? Those are called firefighters, or I call them extreme or reactive parts, right? And those are the ones that culture and society doesn't like at all. But those are kind of the last responders. When everything else fails, they're the ones that show up. And they say this all the time. I'm the one. And all the responsibility lands on me when everything else falls apart. And so we end up having compassion for these extreme parts instead of hating them because society and culture doesn't like them, right? Nobody likes somebody who yells and rages or is shut down and dissociated all the time. But we appreciate the extreme nature of their job also. Different functions, same protective nature, right?
And what I love about it too is that by opening up that curiosity and the compassion, right, all of a sudden firefighter parts make sense. Yes. Right? You're like, oh gosh, this, of course that's what you do. This makes sense. Whereas, especially in yourself, I think what people don't understand is that the person who's exhibiting these behaviors is just as confused about why they can't stop as everyone else is, right?
That's right.
They want that's to right. stop just as much as everyone else does. And they're so confused. And this model gives them such a sense of like, oh, this all makes a lot of sense.
That's right. Even, you know, what ends up happening with me as a therapist, say when I'm working with the suicidal part, like everybody hates them. They want to get rid of them, set up the suicide plan, get the safety plan going, you know, call people, hospitalize you. When you start really embracing the positive intention of a suicidal part, it's a game changer. And what ends up happening for me personally is my heart opens, my heart softens, and I will feel things like, of course suicide makes sense. Thank you so much for helping in that way. Like, you really embrace the positive intention. Most of culture and society in the mental health field focuses on the intent, the effect of the part. Drinking causes trouble. Suicide is harmful. It's permanent damage. You know, they focus on the effect, not the intention. When we focus on the intention, it's a game changer. And then the parts say, finally, finally somebody gets me. And you know what happens? They relax. They don't get louder. Somebody reached out to me on Instagram the other day, said, what's the quote you say, Frank? It's such a great quote. I love it so much. And it was something like, who doesn't feel better when they're seen, heard, known, and validated? Everybody relaxes when they're seen, heard, known, and validated. And oh, by the way, the same is true with our parts. When they feel seen, heard, known, and validated, they relax. So people get all nervous about these extreme parts, but when you move toward them, they actually settle down. They don't get louder. Everybody's worried they're going to get talked to them and they're going to get worse. It's not how it works. It doesn't work like that for humans. And it doesn't work like that for our parts.
Absolutely. So what are some of the misconceptions people have about parts work?
I have multiple personality disorder. That's number one. That's right, the right. Most common. Are you calling me Sybil, Frank? Like, no, I'm not calling you Sybil. I'm kind of calling all of us Sybil, is what I'll say. We all have different aspects of our personality, right? And so I think that's important that people embrace that. You know, I did this project with Pixar a while ago. It never took off. It never kind of materialized, but it was working with a Pixar in the Inside Out movie, right? All the different parts, joy, sadness, fear, anger, disgust. They're coming out with an Inside Out 2, by the way, which I'm super excited about. But it's this concept that those are all normal aspects of our personality. And they did a beautiful job for people to relate to these little parts like people inside, right? So I think that's a misconception. Oh, if I'm have parts, I'm broken, I'm fragmented, I'm not a whole person. And so that really is something that I always just normalize. Like, you know, I'm different when I'm hanging out with my kids than when I'm working on a conference like this, or when I'm out running, or when I'm traveling. I have different aspects of a personality. So that's that's a misconception. The other is this kind of, what would I say? Well, parts, people have this, there's this kind of popularity around IFS right now, and this cult following around IFS. It's very popular. It's next to impossible to get into one of these trainings right now. There's thousands of people on the waiting list. And partly it's because, for me, IFS has grown into this, it's grown so with this popularity because of the experiential nature. When people start experiencing what it's like, what I call self-connection and self-awareness, it's very powerful. There is this, I think this reputation like, oh, it's kind of a cult. Oh, it's kind of weird. They don't incorporate other models of therapy. It's the IFS way is the only way. I think there's this reputation of like, you're either in or you're out within IFS. And I personally want to dispel that myth because I don't believe in that. I don't believe there's one way to heal trauma. I don't believe IFS is the only method. For me, it's a very complete whole method, and I love it, but I also love incorporating other aspects or other types of therapies too. So I want to, one of my messages with IFS is to make it a more inclusive model instead of this exclusionary model. You can't do it unless you can get into the training. And oh, by the way, you can't get into the training. Like, I don't want to teach that model. I think, you know, there's many different ways to work with people. Some people hold trauma somatically, so you use somatic techniques with them. Some people are very cognitive and they're distorted beliefs, and so we're going to use cognitive interventions. And some people are all overwhelmed by emotion, and so we're going to really incorporate emotional techniques. The other thing is spirituality. It's another thing that IFS can incorporate is that those who believe in the spiritual dimensions or energy for that matter, we can incorporate those. So I want to dispel the myth that it's the only way and that, it's the only way and that's the way it can be. And I don't believe that. I think it's a very integrative model and I think you can pull from a lot of different modalities. And then there's one other thing I'll say. Mm-hmm. There's this kind of growing dissent within the IFS community, I think, for some people right now around, oh, is this really, who is this treatment good for? Mm. Right? Who is this treatment good for? Is it good for people with DID? People with DID are too sick to be doing parts work. Can you use this with somebody who are couples, for example? Or what about with kids? Like, where do you use it and where don't you use it? Even with psychotic people, right? Is this okay to use with psychosis? The thing that I want to say about that is I believe the model is useful in all of these dimensions. I think it's very effective for DID. It's beautifully effective for couples. We use it in children up to the age of 3 years of age. We use it with people who have psychosis, because if you think about psychosis, it's a protective response to something else that's underneath it. Like, what better solution than to think the whole world is following you if you're protecting a part that feels alone and unlovable? Like, it's a perfect solution, right? So I wanna kind of say who it's good for and who it's not good for. Will I say IFS is good for everyone? No, I don't think any model is good for everyone. And that's another thing I wanna say. I think there are people who are acutely traumatized that you need to be careful about doing healing work around. So if somebody's in a dangerous situation, I think you may shore up parts to help them get in a safe situation so you can do the healing work. I don't think it's wise to do that kind of vulnerable work when somebody's actively being traumatized. And I think people with brain injuries, I think there's limitations to do IFS with people with brain injuries. So I think you want to be careful. It's not for everyone. And even if it's in theory for someone, this should work for you. There's some people that are very allergic to parts work. Mm. They just don't like it. It doesn't make sense to them. It doesn't resonate for them. And that's really important to pay attention to. Like, oh, but this is good for you. Like, no, it's not good for you. Right. If it doesn't work for you.
Just like, no. Some people can't eat broccoli, right? Like, it some should be good for them. But
you got they it. That's aren't, exactly
well,
right.
Yeah, they don't do well with it. Yeah.
You need to be able to kind of align with where the person's at, mm-hmm. not like one therapy fits all.
Absolutely. And I would also say, and let me know if you agree, but oftentimes you can be doing parts work with your therapist and not know it. Like, yes. Like, and it's not a matter of deception. I know that my therapist was doing parts work with me for 3 years before I had any knowledge that she was
That's
doing
right.
parts work with me. Right. And then
That's
she revealed, right. She was like, how have you liked, you know, when I ask you, is there a part of you that would like to talk about their feelings right now? How do you like that? And I was like, I love it. Actually, it's been great. And she was like, well, it is a thing. It's what I've been doing for 3 years, right? So yes. You can benefit from it without having to, like, you know, your relationship with your therapist yes. doesn't have to be that, like, here's a methodology we're going to do, and it's step-by-step and rigid, and it's more of a methodology for curiosity and exploration and listening, right?
Yeah, a couple things I want to say about that, and I write about this in my book, Transcending Trauma, is you can do IFS without ever even using the word part. You don't have to use the word part. And that's why I was saying earlier, I don't really like the languaging because it imposes something. One of my clients was like, firefighter, I'm a school teacher. Like, I'm not a firefighter. What the hell are you talking
it's
about?
It's in the right? way. Yeah, yeah.
The thing, it does can get in the way. So I'm always using the client's language. So when you're upset, when you're frustrated, when you feel depressed, like if you just use the client's language, which is super important, you can translate, oh, it's a part and maybe it's a reactive part or a wound, but you don't have to say it at all. So we can talk about the different dimensions of your personality, right? Without ever using the word part. So if you're, once you've learned the model, because there are steps to the model, you can incorporate it with clients without ever using the word part or getting in. I never do psychoed. I have to tell you, I'm not a big, this is this model. And this is why, because it pulls for cognitive parts of the client. It gets them out of their experience and into their head. You know, now if a manager part wants to learn all about it before it will relax, fine, go read my book.
Like, right, right. Honestly, yeah, no, it's totally true. Yeah.
You know, but I don't need somebody to understand it in order to do it. It's experiential, and it's really, if I have to put it into its most simplistic form, self-awareness, self-connection. Hmm. Like, that's what this is about, right? So no, we don't need to use the lingo or the language, or, and people who are new do it because they're trying to grasp it themselves, which I understand. That's a process of being an IFS therapist, is learning how to just incorporate it as second nature without, you know, sticking too rigidly to the steps.
Absolutely. So can you tell me, because, you know, if somebody's at the beginning or early in their kind of trauma healing journey, one of the things that might be happening is they're managing discomfort and saving energy. And right, everything feels so hard that it can be more of like, I'm avoiding, I'm managing, it's I'm running away from things that are uncomfortable instead of creating kind of comfort and calm and yeah, joy and creativity and curiosity and all those things. They're not accessible. And so the question that I have coming out of that is, how do you tell the difference at that stage between a characteristic of the big S self, as you would, you know, call it, yeah, and a part that's developed as a result of trauma?
Yeah, so typically what ends up happening in the beginning stages of treatment is it's mostly parts. And I do this, as you see on the screen, it's like parts block access to self-energy. They really do. So there's very, especially in trauma, there's very little access to this self-energy, which we can talk about in a little bit. So it's mostly parts. So, and parts are there to keep the pain away, these protective parts. So mostly, no, this is no good. I don't like this. I gotta get away from this. This is too hard. This is too difficult. That is the nature of protective parts. We expect that. We, you know that that's going to be there. One of the things that we do, which is different for IFS than it might be for some other models of therapy, because of this window of, like, some models of therapy subscribe to the window of tolerance perspective. IFS doesn't really do that. We have a different way to manage overwhelming affect. So we're talking about overwhelming affect. These protectors are there because there's something underneath that's painful that they want to get away from. So the way we approach it is, hey, what if we could move toward that pain in a way that's safe and not overwhelming? Okay, we don't shore up parts to handle the pain. That's what the window of tolerance can do, resourcing parts so they can manage the overwhelm. It's more like, what if I talk to the part that holds the overwhelm directly and show it that it can share traumatic experiences a little at a time? Janina Fisher, a friend and a colleague of mine, calls it a sliver of a memory. Mm. Like that, sliver of a memory. And so we teach parts that hold the overwhelming affect, hey, there's a different way to do this. When you share it all at once, and they often do because they're desperate for help, it's re-traumatizing and it reinforces the trauma and you re-experience it. How does that work for you? I ask the part. And they say, not that well, because they keep reliving. I say, what if we did it a little at a time? And I really work with them relationally to show them sharing it a little at a time allows for the self to be there. Parts don't need to jump in and shove it down and push it away. And then we can have a different kind of connection with trauma. And this is a novel idea for a lot of models of therapy. This is a novel idea for parts inside that carry the pain, because for them, it's so overwhelming. But I say, hey, there's a different way to do it. And I always use the word safety. So we can do this safely. That really intrigues parts. I'm like, oh, it can be done safely. And then we do that slowly over time. And then they learn that if they share a little at a time, self is with them. They actually have connection instead of continually reliving and feeling all alone. So it's a game changer. And a lot of people, it's one of the things I teach in my level two trauma training is how to do that, because it's a skill set that's kind of an advanced skill. It's not what they teach in level one training, but it's an advanced skill to really be with traumatic affect in a different way. And once you kind of are confident with that, it changes how you work with trauma.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I experienced personally was a fear that my overwhelmed parts were going to overwhelm myself.
Yes.
And I remember the point at which that was when I started finally trusting IFS, was when myself was like, don't worry, I don't get overwhelmed. Right.
I got this.
I have healthy boundaries. I communicate what my limits are. Like, I was like, oh, there's a person in there that speaks up for themselves. Right. Like,
The updating I was talking about. That's the updating, the importance of updating, because those parts don't know that. And they're like, wow, there's a resource in here we've never tapped into. And self, even though this is a little tricky for some people, but self doesn't endure trauma. But self can tolerate a lot of feelings.
Well,
in the moment, self gets protected from trauma. I think source energy, which I think self energy is, doesn't get traumatized. Unfortunately, parts endure the trauma. But self, source energy, has capacity to be with feelings in a way that parts aren't aware of. And so they can start feeling the capacity to be with. So key difference, be with instead of be in. Be with instead of be in. That's one of the key differences.
The ultimate definition of holding space just for yourself, right?
Like, yes. Yeah. And that's really important internally for parts to feel, because part of healing is the first step to healing is witnessing, sharing the story. And there needs to be somebody there to share it with inside. And that's holding space.
Yeah, and that's what's so beautiful about this is that, you know, so often the first person in somebody who's been experienced trauma in their lives that can do that for them is someone they have to pay, right? A counselor, therapist. It's someone outside of their immediate family system, their romantic relationships and their friend groups, because those people aren't, you know, they don't know how to do that normally. Most people aren't great at it. We want them to be great at it. We expect them to be great at it. They fall short. Mm-hmm. So we're having to, you know, compensate somebody financially to do that for us, which is great. But then to be able to self-source that internally it's a game changer.
So you're bringing up something that I wasn't going to kind of talk about, but I am going to talk about.
Ooh,
so
okay.
it's very important to me in my personal evolution and journey is this capacity for bringing trauma healing to the general public. Taking it outside the realm of psychotherapy, right? It's been in the realm of psychotherapy, and by no means do I think psychotherapy is not good. So that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying if we are going to globally have an impact on healing trauma in this world, we have to also be able to have it be accessible to people who cannot afford therapy, to people who are never going to go to cultures or organizations or communities that have a lot of shame and stigma around mental health, you know? So I'm very passionate about figuring out ways to bring this healing to the general public. Like, I've worked with people like Matthias Barker. He's a general public kind of person. I'm developing a program, potentially, hopefully. I'm working with Nicole LaPera, for example. She's one of the self-healing circle people. Like, I want to have connections with people who are doing this work in the general public. I think it's important to bring it. Now, do we need to do it in a safe way? Do we need to do it in a way that is respectable and helps people not be left alone with overwhelming affect? Absolutely. So I don't have it all figured out yet, but I really am, you know, working with a lot of coaches now in a way that I haven't before, because I want to figure out a safe way to bring trauma healing to the masses. So, you know, stay tuned with that. One of the things I'm doing right now, I finished the first a version of a memoir. I'm writing my personal story. I'm writing my story of my trauma history as another way to bring trauma healing to the general public. Like, I want people to have this message. Hey, this is possible. Hey, I can do this. I can heal. And oh, look, this guy did it too. He had a trauma history and he was healing. So to show by example and to bring tools to the general public to say, you have the resources. Like, that's what self-energy is. It says you have the internal resources to heal. And I want to help show a safe way for you to be able to do that. So it's very important to me. And thank you for bringing that up, because it's a current passion of mine, honestly.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's why we do these conferences for free, because we want,
you are part. I talk about the interconnected web of trauma healing. And this conference is one of those. When we bring these resources to people, this is a way to get the message out to the masses. So I'm appreciative, because that's part of my larger mission. And absolutely, I think the mission of a lot of us, including this organization. So thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, it occurs to me as you're saying that we, you know, it's definitely been a buzzword for a few years, resilience, right? And people are like, oh, people are resilient, children are resilient. And what they forget is that resilience depends on support. We don't develop resiliency in the face of adversity without support. We develop trauma, right?
Yeah.
And so if we expect, but what's hopeful about all the research is that it only takes one secure, attuned adult in any one person's life to heal, repair, support, see, soothe people. And so by getting this information and these methodologies and this education out as far as we can, we increase the likelihood that more people are able and capable of being in support roles for people facing adversity, right?
Totally. And it's funny that you say that, because for those of you that might go on my website, I have a workshop that I did, a free workshop on resilience and forgiveness in this very nature. It's a fascinating subject for me, because forgiveness is a really powerful piece of trauma healing, which I do not think we talk enough about at all. It's a whole process around forgiveness, but so is this issue of resilience. And, you know, there is explicit and implicit resilience. There's external or internal resilience. Some people have this thing within them that is that it factor that gives them capacity to rise above adversity in a way that some other people don't have. And relationship and connection can certainly foster resilience. So that's through connection. And we can teach people how to be more resilient. There are things that people can do. So there's a lot when we unpack resilience, like how much is temperament, how much is who I am, how much is the environment I grow up in and how that's reparative and fostering resilience, and how much is we have tools to help people increase their resilience when they kind of work in this way. So I think it's a really, really important topic that, again, we don't talk, and resources are a huge, you know, factor in that too, right? Thanks for bringing that up. I think those are two really important topics.
Absolutely. And say just a little bit more about forgiveness. The other thing I think we don't talk enough about is grief, right? But, and I think that kind of go hand in hand, grief and forgiveness. That's what So if you could say just a little bit more about what you mean as far as the importance of forgiveness.
Yeah, certainly. So I'll talk about both, like a little bit. You know, I'm going to be doing this workshop with David Kessler, who's a big grief expert, and him and I are looking at the overlaps and the connections between grief and relational trauma, because there's so much loss involved in relational violation. It's built in, it's inherent in any relational trauma that loss is there. So it's a huge overlapping piece. There are definitely a lot of connections and overlap with them. People think relationally traumatized people are overly dramatic. It's because they don't understand that loss is experienced traumatically for them because of their histories. It's not an over drama. It's the way it's experienced because of the cumulative losses that come up because of relational violations that people grow up in. The forgiveness piece, boy, is such a personal journey for me, as kind of just going my perpetrator, the person who one of my perpetrators, I should say, was my dad, who passed 6 or 8 months ago. And oh my goodness, did I learn so much about forgiveness through that journey of being with him through that process. And I think there are so many decisions and choices that we make around forgiveness. I think it's for us, not for the other person. It's not about the perpetrator in any way, shape, or form. So many people think they need the perpetrator in order to forgive, or forgiving the perpetrator. It's about releasing what we are carrying from our overwhelming experience. Forgiveness is so much more about the person doing the forgiving than it is about who we're forgiving. I think there are choices involved in regards to, do I confront this person? Do I have them in my life? Do I want them in my life? Are they capable of being in my life? What do I need from them in order to have them in my life? So there's a lot of relational dynamics that come up around forgiveness. And most people don't do this effectively because they do it prematurely. They try to forgive before the wound is healed. So there's still an agenda within to protect the pain. And from my perspective, you can't forgive when you still are holding pain around the events. So forgiveness is a post-healing journey from my perspective, because it shows up very differently once I'm not carrying the pain of the trauma. Then I look at the pain of the relationship, because those are two different things. So there's healing, and then there's forgiveness after healing. One of the things I came to realize, which was such a profound effect for me, is loving, sending love to the person who hurt me. Like, that was amazing, to rise above anything that happened to me. And this, I can just feel it now as I'm saying that to you, is sending love to someone who hurt you is the ultimate act in kindness to the world. I'm not affected, and I see you in your vulnerability, in your weaknesses, and I care about you, even though you have parts that have hurt me. That's a very powerful experience. And it is part of the mission of this memoir I talked about, is to show the forgiveness journey, which I think a lot of people don't want to do. Forgiveness is like, oh, it's weak, or, oh, you're giving them, oh, you know, you're condoning it, or all the, you're, you know, there's a lot of negative press around forgiveness, or some religious organizations try to force it on us a little bit too prematurely. You're just supposed to forgive. Like, okay, I'll forgive.
Just
like
turn
a
the
should,
other cheek. Yeah, yeah.
A should forgiveness. There's a process around it that I can say personally has changed my life around the way I'm in the world, no longer carrying what happened to me, and no longer carrying anger or resentment for the person who hurt me. So that's a powerful experience that I want to really share with people.
And it's so important that you contextualize it as a journey, right? Because it's like, in other, if you don't go on the journey toward forgiveness through kind of stages, then it's no different than when you tell a child, like, say thank you for the whatever. Like, it's, they can say the words, but they don't feel the actual gratitude. So if you're, you know, and the same goes with, you know, when one of my sons hits the other one, and when they were young, I'll be like, say sorry. And they'd be like, sorry. Like, oh, I felt that. Yeah.
Totally. I do that all the time. And I want to like hit myself.
Yeah,
doesn't work.
Of course. Of course. It's human nature to practice and model behavior we're not ready for yet. But over time, with practice, we start to understand what we're practicing, even when we don't feel it. And there is a journey toward genuine forgiveness, and grief definitely being a stage along that journey, right?
Huge piece of it. Huge piece of it. Thank you for mentioning that, because that is a really important piece. Like, people are so focused on heal. Like, there's this popular term right now, post-traumatic growth. post-traumatic growth, like everybody's about. And I believe in change after trauma, you know, and how are you going to grow after trauma? But I think it's like post-healing growth, like heal first. And then all the growth that happens as a result of that. And that's changes within yourself, in the world, and the way you relate to people. That's also changes in the way you relate to the person, the people or the persons or the institutions that have hurt you. So I think post-healing growth includes forgiveness, and it includes change in our lives and in the way we kind of live in the live, carry ourselves and live in the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you said earlier, it's with the healing, it's we don't, and you have, writing a memoir will know this, we don't write from our wounds, we write from our scars, right? Mm-hmm. Like we have to heal before we can make sense of how we were hurt.
Yeah. And it's been like writing this memoir has been such a healing journey for me. I'm like, oh my gosh, I have spent so much money on therapy my life. I'm still in therapy. And just the process of sorting through this story, like being able to kind of really connect to it fully in that kind of a way has been incredibly healing for me, incredibly healing. So that's another, like, there's a lot of different ways to heal. There's a lot of different ways to heal.
And the importance of the journey and the practice of it, right? Because you're never kind of, I don't, I mean, you're never done. I hate to burst people's bubbles, but right when you think you're done, life will serve you up a test, right? Yes. And be like, yes, you have the tools. You can handle this, but you will never be totally done over it or unaffected for the rest of your life, right?
Well, you mentioned a couple of things I want to say about that, because I think that's really important. There is this myth that, oh, you heal it and it's permanent healing and it's all over. That has not been my experience, even though for many years I've wanted it to be such. Okay, I've really, oh yeah, once I heal that wound, it's going to be gone forever. That's not been my experience. My experience is this, is that yes, other events that come up in life can reactivate that space in me, but I experience it differently because of the healing that I've done. I recover much more quickly because of the experience that I had gone through around healing. And it brings me to a different layer and dimension of that kind of hurt. So it's like, it elevates me. Every time the wound gets reactivated, I don't know if that's the right word, but it elevates me because I learn a different dimension of what that kind of hurt is. So it's constantly an evolution. So it's not that once it's gone, it's over. It's each time it shows up, there's a different dimension of it that you need to learn and you can grow from. So people, instead of getting bummed out, oh my God, no, it's part of the growth, part of the growth. And I do feel like we are never done. I will never be done. I think that's part of our journey here is to grow and evolve as souls. And I don't think we're done. I think we keep learning and growing and evolving.
Absolutely. I think that's a wonderful, beautiful place for us to stop. And I can't wait for the memoir to come out 2023. Yeah. So Frank Anderson, tell us where people can find out more about you and the book that's already out and the book that's coming out.
Yes, yes. So a couple things. Oh, you mean these books? I had my team say, you got to change your background, Frank. So there's Transcending Trauma is one of my books. And then the IFS Internal Family System Skills Training Manual. They're both books that you can find on Amazon. You can find them through PESI, which is a publishing company, PESI.com. The best place to kind of find out about me and what I'm doing and where I am and where I'm heading to is to go to my website, which is frankandersonmd.com. And you can sign up for my mailing list and all the courses that I'm doing. And I'm on all the social media platforms. I've gotten so, because of my connection with all these social media people, somebody said, oh my gosh, you're becoming an influencer. I'm like, maybe, I don't know. But so yeah, I'm certainly on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. I'm now on TikTok and I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter. So you can find me in all those places and those are all on my website. So
fantastic. Yeah. Dr. Frank Anderson, thank you as always for being with us.
And thank you so much for having me. And thank you everyone out there for listening.